the two points that they are meaning, that the tea has not arrived.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it is, well, it just, I've understood it has just arrived now. So I think members can grasp, and indeed also you, the delegate, you can just grab a cup of coffee, bring it here with, and we can continue business here inside. You can have your coffee here. Sorry. Yeah, there. You can, whilst it is a good paper, you can quickly grab yourself whatever you need outside. Those who have not had breakfast, those who have had some breakfast, they can have coffee. Those who have had coffee, then they can relax. The program for this session is thus that ASAF will be addressing us on the annual report and their financial statements. And thereafter, then we will have our domestic business, which should entail looking at the BRR report. And indeed our international oversight trip. So I request, after we have finished the business with the ASAF, that members remain and we deal with
The apology is accepted. No, separate from the mercy, that's not my apology for arriving late. You know my challenge. So I got lost. The leg couldn't carry me fast, hence I delayed. Thanks.
But you have not introduced yourself.
Can you permission me? Nina Pena Pemeti. Yeah, Pemeti, look at Karatsu. Get a cold province in your hunting, originating your son.
The next member, they have already introduced themselves at the back. I think I have two people who have not introduced themselves behind them. But they are in, they have to introduce themselves.
Hello, members of the first committee, members and guests. I'm a member of Shuchuk from CSR or Parliament Chiefs.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Bongan Nsanga from PMG.
Chair, this gives an outline of the structure of the presentation and gives an indication of the nature of what we will be covering, and it follows fairly faithfully what is in the annual report itself. And my colleagues and I will be presenting different sections of it, and I'll be doing the introduction. I thought I would start off by just giving the committee an indication of a brief history of the Academy, which was founded in 1996. It was established as the National Academy of Science with the Academy of Science Act in 2001. And the major activities of the Academy have flowed subsequent from its establishment as a National Academy of Science.
Just be careful of your macro, it's away from you, so it doesn't catch up as very nice. And that was very nice.
I'll move closer to it. Chair, I think that the National Academies of Science generally have two functions. The one is what is called the Learned Society function, and we will come on to that at a later stage. But secondly, they have an important role in providing providing advice on policy. And so I think it's in that dual role that the Academy is currently operating. You can see from the vision of the Academy that it sees itself as the apex organization for science and scholarship in South Africa. And in particular, I would like to emphasize that the Academy includes all scholarly disciplines. So that's natural scientists, engineers, social scientists, and the humanities. And that has always been the case since the founding of the Academy. It's important that the Academy be internationally respected and be involved in international activities, and you will see some of those presented to you later in the presentation. And our vision is also that membership of the Academy is something that the country's active scholars would like to aspire to. And the most important thing, I think, is that the Academy, through its membership, represents a collective resource which can be very effectively used to generate evidence-based advice for a range of national problems. And we'll discuss some of the work that we've been doing in that respect. So this gives you an indication of the mandate of the Academy. It's to promote and inspire outstanding achievements in all fields of inquiry. And it's also important for it to undertake studies on matters of public interest. And some of those studies we will be reporting on later, because they provide evidence-based scientific advice both to government and a range of other stakeholders. I think in relation to the role of the Academy, it's been increasingly developing its policy advisory role, and it does so through a number of different mechanisms that we will report on also later in this presentation. I think it's important for the Parliamentary Committee to understand that the role of the Academy is complementary to that of the Science Councils, but its role doesn't overlap with the Science Councils. And just to give you an indication of the specific niche of the Academy, and particularly the advice that the Academy offers, is the attributes of this is that the advice should be independent, it should be objective. It's also based on what we call volunteerism. In other words, the people who are involved in these studies donate their time in order to undertake the studies, and all that is paid is the expenses that are incurred in participating. And the important aspect of this is that it's based on a rigorous analysis of the evidence, and once the report is completed, it is then peer-reviewed. And perhaps the members would be interested to know that the peer-review mechanism was actually invented by academies of science and is now used in a variety of different fields. And we regard it as a very important mechanism for ensuring the quality of the reports that are prepared. I think that there are two attributes of the Academy that are particularly significant. One is its multidisciplinary nature, which spreads over a range of different disciplines, and the other thing is the insistence on transparency of the processes that we're involved in. So those the first two items. The third item in relation to the role of the Academy is its increasing impact in its international role in engagements with a range of national academies outside of the country. The Academy has been a member of the network of African Science Academies since the inception of that network, and currently we are chairing the network. So the Academy of Science is now chairing the network of African Academies of Science, and is looking at the ways in which its role in relation to offering advice to the African Union can be developed, because networks of academies generally offer advice at a regional level rather than a national level. And then the other activity that the Academy is involved in is being strongly involved in the initiation of new academies and the development of academies in the SADC region. And in that respect, we've been engaging with the Zimbabwe Academy with the potential to build an academy in Namibia, with the Mozambican Academy and a number of others. And then with the accession of South Africa to the BRICS group of countries, we are building on the collaborations that we already have with the national academies in those countries. We have formal agreements with the Russian Academy of Science and with the Chinese Academy of Science, and we have strong relationships with the Indian Academy of Science and the Brazilian Academy of Science. So I think that in that context, the Academy also has an important role to play, although exactly what it will be still needs to be defined. In relation to governance, this slide gives you an indication of the way in which the Academy is governed. It comprises of 13 members, 12 of them elected by the members of the Academy, and one is appointed by the Minister, and the individual is a representative from NACI. The Academy has 5 office bearers who are listed there. And in October 2010, 4 new council members were elected to the council. 1 new council member was appointed as the NACI representative, and 2 advisors have been appointed, and those are listed in the annual report. We have 3 governance committees. We have an executive committee, which allows for important matters to be dealt with speedily. We have an audit committee, which is served by Mr. Chiruwani, and he will be reporting on the finances of the Academy. And then we have a Human Resources Committee, which deals with the Secretariat of the Academy. And, of course, the activities of the Academy are guided by the Act and a set of regulations which have been established by the Council. The Secretariat of the Academy consists now of 21 staff and an executive officer, and is supported by a chief operations officer. And I think that that secretariat is operating effectively. The offices of the Academy are in rented premises in Persicor Park in Pretoria. And the council has an ad hoc facilities committee which is meeting at the moment to address the need for a more permanent home for the Academy. This slide here gives you an indication of the growth of the Secretariat of the Academy over time, starting from 2003 and going to 2011. And you can see there's been significant growth over time with the growth in the activities of the Academy. If I could just deal very briefly with the goals and strategic priorities. Obviously, one of the major goals of academies is the recognition and reward of excellence in scholarly activities. That's generally why they've been set up. In addition to that, the Academy has to promote innovation and scholarly activity, because the only way in which you actually acquire new members with that kind of excellence is if you promote innovation and scholarly activities, and we'll deal with that a little later. And then the third strategic priority is, as I've mentioned before, the promotion of effective scientific advice on matters of policy. And then the fourth is that the Academy needs to be very active in the promotion of the interest in and the awareness of science, both in terms of education for learners in schools, but also in terms of the promotion of the understanding of science amongst the general public. And then finally, as I mentioned, the promotion of national and regional international linkages. Recognition of and reward of excellence is by way of election to the memberships, and I've indicated on the slide there the way in which we do that. During 2010, 16 new members were elected, and at the end of the financial year, the total membership of the Academy was 351. There's been a new round of elections, so the numbers have gone up, but in the reporting period, that's the state of the membership. And must apologize for the missing bar in this graph. It's not that we suddenly stopped electing members in 2009. I'm not quite sure where the bar disappeared to, and we couldn't find it. but you'll see that there's been a steady growth in the number of memberships, in the number of members. In addition to the election to the membership, we do award two Science for Society gold medals for outstanding academic achievement. And in the reporting period, Professor Eugene Klutter got the gold medal for his innovations in the area of water. And you may have heard about the innovations that he created for producing potable water from poor water sources. So we believe that was an important, both an important innovation and important benefit to society. And I would like to mention to the committee that it's a combination. A person who is simply excellent in their field of science is unlikely to win the gold medal. There has to be a direct connection of the activities that they're involved in and the public benefit that evolves from that. In the case of Professor Diane Hildebrand, she works in the area of chemical engineering and particularly processing, and her work has been very significant for the development of some of the processes in Sasol. So that was the reason for their awards. Then the other activities that the Academy is involved in is trying to encourage the new generation of scientists to achieve excellence, and the award of the Sydney Brenner Postdoctoral Fellowship was made to Dr. Marakalala from the Institute for Infectious Diseases and Molecular Medicine at the University of Cape Town, and I think he has now moved to the CSIR, where his work, at least in Cape Town, was based on TB, an outstanding young scientist. And then in addition to that, the Academy is involved with DST and the Academy of Science of the Developing World with the awarding of the what's now called the AU TWAS Young Scientist Award. The award was not made in 2010 because we were renegotiating the award, because it was called the TWAS Young Scientist Award, but because these are regional in nature, it was renamed as the AU TWAS Award, and so we weren't able to complete the negotiations about the renaming in 2010, but we have made awards in 2011. And in addition to that, the Academy has been facilitating the development of a young Academies of Science. If I could just make a comment, the average age of the membership of the Academy tends to be on the geriatric side, and we're looking at ways in which we can involve young scientists in the development of the academy. So we've made very good progress in the establishment of a young science academy, and it was in fact launched in September 2011. And I think it will have a very significant effect on developing the membership in the future. I would like to also, I would like at this stage to hand over to Professor Geovitz and ask him if he could deal with the next set of activities, which have to do with the promotion of innovation and scholarly activity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. And continuing then, there's a focus initially on the learned society aspect of the Academy's work, but it's always closely coupled to these public service. The first is that we annually invite a distinguished visitor, and we've simply given some information about Professor Winnacker, who's a very influential German scientist, probably the most influential scientist currently, president of the German Research Foundation and general secretary of the European Research Council, who visited a set of regional centers and gave public lectures. I've realized in both this item and the next one about the regional lectures given, public lectures given in different centers, that it would be a good idea, Honourable Chair, if we sent your committee, you and your members, notices for these meetings, because they tend to be on matters of considerable public interest, and they touch on some of the core issues of modern science. So therefore, we will ensure that in future you do receive the notice for the monthly meetings and lectures which are held in Cape Town, as well as our visiting distinguished lecturers. We also hold annual symposia, and the one that's listed there was in association with one of our consensus studies, in which we're giving very serious attention to the humanities and social sciences. Chair, the next slide concerns the publication by the Academy of the South African Journal of Science, which is an attempt to provide all South African citizens, as well as all South African scientists and scholars, with both a way of keeping abreast of what's happening at the cutting edge, as well as a forum for inputs into policy by scholars. And so the Journal of Science has been upgraded considerably in the last year under the able editorship of Professor Michael Cherry, who is also the South African correspondent to Nature. And we are modeling this on the role that Nature plays as one of the world's two preeminent science and scholarship journals. So the next slide will give you some indication that the content serves a multidisciplinary audience, so every article is written in such a way that it can be read by a wide audience. As I said, it aims to be the nature of the African continent. We have made great strides in bringing it up to date, so it's published regularly and appears on time. 6 issues were, as planned, published last year. We issue media briefs, which again should reach you and your committee, Honourable Chair. In future, we will see to that. We have an online manuscript management system, and the business strategy is to expand the journal, and especially expand it as an avenue for other South African journals to bring to the attention of a multidisciplinary audience the most significant recent publications. So it'll be possible by reading this journal to have your attention drawn to important results that are published in any of the other South African journals, which I'll come to later. So the next slide shows that we are, in addition to this, expanding considerably our policy advisory activities. And on the next slide, one of these advisory, in fact the first major report, was based on a very detailed study of scientific or scholarly publishing in and from South Africa. Honourable Chair, you and your committee will know that one of the key indicators of the ambitious aspiration that we have to create a scholarly knowledge society, as well as the national system of innovation to be energized, that one of the key indicators is publishing in peer-reviewed journals, as well as patents and many other outputs, graduation of students, etc. So we looked at the publishing and came to many important conclusions and made recommendations which were accepted by the Departments of Science and Technology as well as the Department of Higher Education and Training, and which we are busy implementing. So I'd like to emphasize that this is something which is overseen by one of our senior committees, the Committee on Scholarly Publishing in South Africa. It's an ambitious intervention into the NSI, National Center for Innovation, aimed at enhancing the capacity to produce and publish research, and especially to make it visible internationally. There are multiple projects, and it is largely funded, not entirely funded, by a multi-year DST contract. Next slide. So we see the scholarly publishing as being at the heart of the Academy as representing the apex organization of academic excellence. And it is not being done by any other body, such as the NRF, etc. It is something that we have now built into one of our main activities. We want to enhance human capital development in the country and raise the quantity quality of South African published research outputs, recognizing that human capital in science and technology is the single biggest asset a country can have in promoting national development. And we lag similarly placed countries in publishing and other outputs. So what we're doing at the moment is, with the support of the two departments I mentioned, we are implementing the recommendations in multiple projects. Some are time-bound projects, others are interventions that remain forever and will be nurtured by the Academy. Next slide. So the first of this is that we are carrying out, this is unique in the world, where a country of our kind and size has done peer review of the discipline grouped scholarly journals published in this country. This means that we form panels and we have independent peer reviewers who look at the last 4 or 5 years of issue of the journals and eventually reach consensus on a report. And Honourable Chairperson, I want to emphasize that the report is not so much punitive as improvement-oriented, very much like the audits of higher education institutions. And so each of these reports, which has reviewed about 40 journals in social sciences and in agriculture and basic life sciences, in each case, a whole set of recommendations have been made for strengthening the journals and making them much more important both for us here and for international and Africa, especially Africa. And at the moment, we are carrying out 4 other studies which should lead to our having reviewed 2/3 of all the journals that are accredited by the Department of Higher Education and Training by the middle of next year. So this is a very important thing to target these journals. Honourable Chairperson and members, I want to emphasize that we are very conscious of the fact that it's policy to increase the international profile of South African R&D. And obviously the targeting of high-impact international journals is a very important thing, and we support that 100%. But we know that in certain disciplines, and especially for the capacity development of young scholars, students, postgraduate students, and young academics, that having a local journal that will do a professional job in essentially training people to publish good articles is fundamental. And so the main role of our local journals, and there are approximately 250 of them, which is a much too large a number as we ourselves found, and we are recommending that some of them should be merged or published in a different way. This is a huge contribution to capacity development, especially. Without it, we will not be able to train people to get to the point where they can publish in the very competitive international literature. So the next slide. We have also reviewed scholarly books, which are hugely important for the humanities and social sciences. We have made recommendations for better peer review, because you find this rather haphazard, and improved public policy, and we have formed a National Scholarly Book Editors Forum, which is now making proposals, amongst others, for a possible National Scholarly Books Fund to support the publishing of books which otherwise would not be able to appear. We've also formed the National Scholarly Editors Forum already in its 5th year, which aims to improve the standard of editing and peer review in the country. And one of the most interesting things and exciting new developments is that we are developing an online, free online, scientific writing training service. And this will be piloted next month, will appear for anybody in the whole country. It's a level playing field. Anybody will have access to a 4-tier service for being able to write good papers which will be published, which will get through peer review, and which will have an enormously benefit. for example, in Pakistan and India, some Indian states have had the country itself take out a much discounted national license, which means that all institutions have access to a very large number of journals. In Brazil, for a total of approximately 200 million, there's a much bigger country and many more institutions, they have a free online access to 15,000 scientific journals in all fields for 200 higher education institutions and research organizations. If you compare that with the cost, were they to follow the normal route of purchase, even when buying in consortia, this is something like a four-fold reduction in total cost to the country system. So we will be making a report, and we think it will be a very good idea to follow this route. Next slide. Sorry, this is the other thing that we are working with Brazil. We mentioned earlier that we are in the BRICS connection, that we have decided to get support from the government, which have been granted, to build an open access. This is a free online electronic publishing platform for high quality South African journals. Already 20 journals are on the platform. We're aiming for 180. This means that anybody in the whole world can get instant access to every article in these journals. It also is a highly indexed system, which means that you can work out impact factors for regional journals like ours, and this is providing an entirely new ballgame for working out how important research is. And there is much research in public health, in social development, etc., which is mainly published in local journals, and where now we'll be able to say that this is high impact, important work, and get a better way in which one can fund and support researchers. This is an indication of the growth in this platform. Month by month, we are adding journals. It's one of the fully indexed systems, extends across the whole of South America, and we hope eventually this will become the developing country indexed publication service to give us more leverage in the world of science and technology worldwide. Next slide. Now, I'm handing over, if you don't mind, to Dr. Rambau, who will take the next section. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable members, this section actually is a continuation on how ASAF promote innovation and scholarly activities. And from here, it's one of them is capacity development for the young scholars, and which I'll discuss in the next slide. And again, the capacity development for women in science. We have currently hosting a national chapter for organizations for women in science in the developing world, which was previously known as PROWS. Here we have a number of activities that we engage, but currently we are doing a survey to determine what are the activities that women who are involved in science are doing, and so that we can be able to develop. And I think Prof. Kivas has already explained on the next bullet with regard to online scientific writing, because we see publication as one important indicator to show that there's growth within science area. And the next slide would actually move deeper into activities that we do that in terms of capacity development for young scholars. ASAF has a responsibility to foster the next generation of scholars, and in doing that, we have mentioned that we have awarded a Sydney Brenner Fellowship to Dr. Marakalala. And it's just only one, and we're considering to see if we could increase that, because we have realized that there's much need. So in the next coming years, we would be looking at developing a model that would increase more postdoctoral fellowships. And again, we host an annual Young Scientist Conference. In 2010, the focus of that conference was on biodiversity, and we managed to attract 84 young students who presented their abstract to the committee. And this year, the focus was changing lives through chemistry. The topics are selected based on the international year theme. As you can see that this year it was chemistry in 2011. And again, we have embarked on other young scientist outreach program, like during the National Science Week, we made presentations to the students in tertiary
Thank you, Chair. I will deal very briefly with the forms of evidence-based policy advice that we're currently involved in. There are two types of studies. The one is what we call a consensus study, and those are studies which are done by a panel, and the panel has to come to its conclusions after sifting the evidence based on a consensus, and it generally leads to a set of strong policy recommendations, which we can then make to the appropriate government department. We also have forum studies, and these are studies in which we get a group of invited experts together to discuss an issue, make presentations, and exchange views on the topics. The deliberations are not generally aimed at making recommendations based on consensus, but by pooling the expertise so that it's possible to translate the knowledge that you've gained there into some practical recommendations. And 2 weeks ago, we held a study of this kind on nuclear safety, and I think that the outcome of that workshop is going to be significantly of significant interest, because it involved the participation of the Royal Society of London, the Academy of Science in Paris, and the Science Council of Japan. And they in particular were able to give us a very good insight into the events at Fukushima. So in terms of nuclear safety, I think this is going to be an important study. The studies are focused in three broad strategically selected areas, and I'll show you a list of them in a moment. It's health, environment and energy, and human capacity development. And the studies are generally closely aligned with government priorities, which I've listed there. The value of this kind of policy advice is that it stems from the methodology which is used, because in general what we attempt to do is be authoritative and objective and independent, and it's based on the methodology which involves achieving consensus amongst a set of people who are leaders in the field. And I've given an indication there of what the methodology actually involves, and it generally results in a set of strong recommendations which are based on the evidence which have been assembled. I give you a list here of the 9 studies that the Academy has already completed. Some of them you can see have been done over the recent period. The earliest one, the first one, Professor Givers has already referred to, and that's the one that involved the scholarly program and has resulted in the implementation of a number of the recommendations. The last one is the study on the status of the humanities in South Africa, and obviously that is an issue which is still a matter of discussion between ourselves and the Department of Higher Education and Training and the Department of Science and Technology. I've indicated here some of the impact and uptake of these recommendations. There's obviously some media coverage, because our feeling is always that we should get some public understanding of the studies that we're doing. In terms of policy influence, the PhD study is influencing DST's human capital development strategy. We've spoken about the scholarly books and the way in which the recommendations from that were implemented. This gives you an indication of the forum studies that we've completed. It's a wide range of activities. The first one we did was an investigation of what is evidence, because you will have heard through the discussion that we've had this morning that we repeat that the studies are evidence-based. But we felt that we should start on the initial forum study on what was evidence and how you use it, and then we've used that subsequently. You will see that we've also done forums on genetically modified organisms, on TB, and also on a strategy to prepare for the long-term burden of HIV/AIDS. So So it's a range of activities in the health and a number of other domains. We've also started, together with our colleagues on other parts of the continent, preparing what are called policymakers' booklets. And these are booklets that are relatively short and in which the evidence is collected in a way which is more accessible than the long studies that we produce. And the first one was in relation to some of the MDGs that related to maternal, newborn, and child health. The second one was in relation to improving energy access in sub-Saharan Africa. And the third one is inquiry-based science education for girls, which will be released at the African Academies meeting in Kampala in about 2 weeks' time. And what we intend to do is to distribute those policymakers' booklets so that it makes the information more accessible to the policymakers. We've also produced a number of statements on the subjects which you see there. And then just recently we've started another intervention, which is policy commentaries. We were asked to comment on the IRP for electricity, and we put a panel together to actually make comments and recommendations about future IRPs, and those have been discussed with the Department of Science and Technology and the Department of Energy. And I think that what we should really emphasize is that these interventions are on different timescales. A consensus study takes of the order of about 1 year to 18 months to complete, because you have to sift through the evidence and you have to do a thorough job. And that takes time. The forum studies can be done on a relatively short period, because you can get the experts together, you can have a workshop, and you can distill the knowledge fairly quickly. In terms of the policy commentaries, you need to have these commentaries in order for them to be of value to policymakers in a relatively short space of time, on the order of 2 to 3 months at the longest. And so we've designed these different interventions to serve different purposes. And I think all of them are in relation to the core activity of the Academy, which is to provide that those particular pieces of advice. And then in the period on which we're reporting, we've published three consensus studies. The one was the PhD study, enhancing the production of postgraduates in South Africa. Then a report on peer review of scholarly journals in agriculture and the basic life sciences, and a peer review study of scholarly journal in social sciences and related fields. In relation to the other forms of studies, we've had two forum studies completed, one on mathematics in secondary schools, and another one on genetically modified organisms in African agriculture. And it's likely that this latter study will be one which will be taken forward on a continental level. And then we have a policymaker's booklet on improving energy access and a statement on academic freedom.
Honourable Chair and members, the next very short section has to do with something that I believe this committee has seen before, which is that somewhat uniquely for national science academies, we are very keen on a science magazine, a national science magazine, which is targeted particularly at senior learners, in other words, in the secondary schools before they go to university as well as at university. And so this quarterly science magazine, which is very well edited by Dr. Bridget Farham, is now expanding. And in the next slide, you'll see that it is designed to showcase South African research and raise issues which are current in the country. The target audience is also the general public. It is distributed free to public high schools, and at the moment we've scaled it up to 25,000 copies. The general aid schools get 10 per school, and 4,000 other public schools receive 3 copies each. And the most powerful intervention recently has been to have an interactive website, Quest Interactive, which has been hugely successful because it expands access to Quest to any learner who has access to the internet. And this now is proven to be the real factor that is making Quest almost universally active in the learner and young scholar area. I'll hand back to Dr. Rambau.
To make sure that whatever we're doing, it's contributing to science development within the SADC region and Africa as a whole, and even participating in the international forums. Also, we do have to collaborate with our national stakeholder relations. In that regard, we have formal agreements with a number of academies. We have 4 there, which is Uganda, Russia, China, and Nigerian academies. And we do have other informal collaborations with countries like Brazil, India, not listed there, and Kenya, and others. But on that field as well, we do collaborate on specific areas like science education and water with Uganda National Academy of Science. We have biotechnology, nanotechnology, and cyber infrastructure with the Russian Academy of Science. And we participate with NASAP. We are currently involved in initiating new academies within Africa and also strengthening those that are existing. Currently within SADC, we're working very closely with Mozambique. We have hosted their secretariat at the academy, and we have also hosted some officials from Namibia in terms of assisting them in establishing an academy over there. And if you look at the linkages that we have, you would see that we participate at the international, which used to be International Academy Panel, but now it's called Global Network of Science Academies. We are also an executive member of Inter-Academy Council and participate again on IMP, which is Inter-Academy Medical Panel. So these are some of the organizations, and it has been mentioned that recently we hosted the Academy of Science for the Developing World Conference in South Africa. And we on an annual basis, we attend the G8+5 grouping of academies, which might now be G20. And also, we are the presidents of African Science Academies, NASAC network. And another area or forum that we participate is the Science for Society Forum for President of Academies, which is hosted in Japan. Also, the Human Rights Network of Science of Academies and Science Academies. And another platform is African Science Academy Development Initiatives, which we have hosted a conference, and the Honorable Chair was part of the people that presented in that ASADI conference. These are some of the things that we are doing to make sure that whatever we are doing is not only benefiting South Africa, but it benefits even other neighboring countries.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to skip the next 2 slides and go to the financial matters of the Academy, and then come back to those last 2 slides to wrap up. But I'll ask Mr. Chilwani to take us through these 2 slides, which give an indication of the audited financial information of the Academy.
Thank you, Prof. Members, Honorable Chair. All that my colleagues have presented converge here in the area of finances. In front of you, we are presenting an abridged financial statement. The details, or a detailed financial, audited financial report, is in our annual report, which I think all members have copies. In this abridged financial statements, with relation to income, there are 2 areas that I think I would like to highlight. As
as you have noticed that, you know, in comparison, our income in 2011 and 2010, there is a huge difference there. The reason for the difference is that actually our activities in relation to the expenses that we incur are aligned to, you know, the number of activities that we take, especially the studies and conferences. And therefore, you know, we do get funding for studies and conferences, which are periodic. And it is for that reason that in 2010, our total income was in the region of 26 million. Something that I also want to highlight there is with regard to the interest received, you will see that, you know, in this period under review, the interest that we generated decreased substantially. These are the direct consequence of the recession that we experienced globally. Moving on to the next slide, which deals with expenses. As I indicated in the previous slide, our income is determined by a large extent, you know, the studies and the conferences that we undertake. And therefore, in relation with the expenses that we incurred, as you will see, in 2010, there was more of the activities that we undertook, and therefore, the expenses as well. We did spend quite more than we did in 2011. Now, pointing at the operating expenses, specifically, you will see that in 2010, we spent more in that regard than compared to 2011. This was as a result of the relocation from the DST building to our new premises, well, rented premises. We had to lay a substantial amount in infrastructure setup. It is as a result of that. One other aspect that I think it's worth touching on is in relation to salaries and contributions. Most members will be aware that ASAF was getting this funding from the United States National Academies over a period of 6 years. And our salaries were covered by that funding to a region of about 25%. But that funding came to an end, and therefore that meant that that expense had to be had to revert to mainstream academy line item, which is administration. It is for that reason that you know, you have that fluctuation. Otherwise, I take it that most of the line items are self-explanatory. But you know, we can take questions when that time comes.
Honourable Chair, I would like now just to highlight some key achievements and challenges for the Academy. I think that what the Academy has done is it's demonstrated an ability to deliver effectively on its mandate with a fair level of efficiency. The tangible outputs we've already discussed in relation to the periodical publications, the evidence-based reports, and the open access platform for the scholarly journals, which is in development at the moment. And I think that in the four strategic areas, we've also had some significant impact in the policy advisory role, in the contribution to human capital development, innovation and scholarly activity, contribution to science education and public awareness of science, and also a contribution to the national, region, and international science and technology development through our activities and interactions with other science academies globally. I would just like to indicate that there are some still challenges. They're not unique to our National Academy. I think many other academies face the same challenges.
One is to achieve recognition of the policy advisory role by government and other stakeholders. And I think that's a general factor that all academies have to address. In our own particular domain, I think because the academy is one of the most recently established bodies, one of our major challenges has been to give a clear indication of the particular niche of a national academy and the degree to which it undertakes activities which are not part of the activities of other entities in the national system of innovation. We also currently are in rented premises and believe that for a national academy in the longer term, we would need to occupy a building which is suitable for an academy. And we also have significant challenges with the uptake and the impact of report recommendations, but the advice that we've received from older academies is that you simply have to expend a lot of energy on the process. And if you do, you will have success in the longer term. And then I think that in relation to representation in the membership, we're going to have to look at different mechanisms for ensuring that we get appropriate balances in the membership in relation to discipline, race, and gender. And I think those are the main challenges that we still follow. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Prof. Well, here's the report. Members, just been presented. I'll allow the platform for members to interact with you now. I see the hands are already up. It means that the members have interest in what you've said. Want more clarity. I will start that side and come back this way.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to all the presenters. Very interesting report. Very exciting, actually. Quite happy with much of it. But I do have some questions, unfortunately quite a few. But I'll try and go very quickly. And I'll just go through your slides, but they're not numbered. So I'm not quite sure how you're going to recognize what I'm speaking to, but I'll try and go very quickly. Under the vision, you talk about membership being a collective resource. Precisely how are the members used? I know you have a couple of committees, and there are the actual research that's done. I presume those members are part of the research teams, but do the research teams go beyond the membership, or exactly what is that? On your mandate, you speak about either proactively or on request, doing research. Now, my question is, what is the ratio between what you do, which is of your own initiative, versus being requested to do so? And if you're requested, it's by government and other stakeholders. Who are the other stakeholders, other than government or semi-government or the state? Who else is there? And later on at the end, you give a list of some of the publications that or research studies that you've done. Can you give some indication which you initiated versus which were requested by government? And then on the same issue then, what is your relationship to government? You mentioned one of the challenges, of course, is being taken seriously by role players, stakeholders. What is your relationship to the executive generally? Because, you speak about EST, you speak about higher education, made a specific reference to minerals and energy at one stage, but do the aligned departments of government know you exist? Do you market yourself as a service, potential service, to all line departments? If Department of X wants to get some information, would they even know you exist? And if so, are you used? On the role of the Academy, you mentioned that you are complementary to the science councils, but not. I can't remember what you weren't. You're complementary, but not in conflict with or not overlapping. Could you just expand on that slightly more? I'm not 100% sure that I understand the difference. Going here. The secretariat, you've got 21 staff led by executive officer, etc. If you look at growth, it's quite startling. From 2003 to now, that's a pretty rapid growth in staffing. So my question is really, It seems quite large. Well, I don't know. I don't know what standards you would use, but why is it growing so quickly, and is there any kind of optimal size? I mean, do you see that graph that you show just continuing into the future, you know, from 21 to 31 to 100? I mean, when does it stop? Just the question. It's not a criticism, Matt. It's just a parity. Sorry, these holdings. Oh, yes. On the promotion of activity and the scholarly activity, you spoke about the publishing program, and there particularly there's a multi-year DST contract. Why would you have a DST contract as opposed to, I mean, why would the funding for that project be where you have a contract with DST as opposed to the DST's general funding of your other operations? When I look at the completed consensus studies and the forum studies, there's quite a sort of low take up at the beginning, and then it sort of speeds up a bit, and then this year you're slowing down slightly. I mean, you've got sort of, I'm just going like year by year, it'd be 110232 is the outputs for those years. And on the forum studies, it's 30222. Is there any kind of, target that you have for these studies, or is it as and when somebody commissions them or you decide that you want to do them? You spoke about, for example, this IRP for electricity. I mean, one of the huge things of this country, of course, is we're all very interested in the energy program of the country, but you spoke about this particular, you've got this particular resource plan here. Do you ever get consulted to do specific, you know, more narrow studies, say wind energy or solar power plant in the northwest or anything of that kind? Was it always very general, high level, policy level stuff? This one puzzles me. You made a statement on academic freedom at one stage. Could you expand on that? What prompted you to have to do that? On your financials, I noticed that, well, the grants and donations that you quote in this presentation to us is not the same figures as in your report. So you show grants and donations of 17 million this year, whereas the annual report shows, does show the same. I'm misreading something, my apologies there. Okay, scrap that one.
The mic?
I'll leave it at that.
The mic is closer to you. That's all.
The next one, I said you must just along the road towards my direction.
Thank you. A couple of questions that I'd like to ask, first of all, based on the presentation. In the role of the Academy, you said that most of your work is, or your research work, your output is done by volunteers. How do you determine, is there not a conflict then with some of the commissioned research, or those people, how do you separate them between the volunteers and the commissioned research? How do you choose those? And also what I want to know is who determines what you're going to study, your proactive stuff? Who sits down and decides what is worth studying, and is there a need for that? Your secretariat, an awful lot of increase in part-time staff. What do those part-time staff do, and why are they part-time? And obviously the impact that it would have on your financial status. Also, I'm wanting to know your outputs. What impact really has there been on the areas in which you have targeted this? I mean, what I think particularly of maths and science education in schools. I mean, has anything happened with that? Has everybody said this is a good book and put it on the shelf? Or, is any of your stuff actually being, any of your research actually being implemented? And then obviously then there's sort of, going on with Peter's question is, do you market it? Do people know that it's out there? I assume they do, but are they taking it seriously and any of it is implemented? And your special policymakers booklets, how are they being put out into the field so that policymakers know that you've done them? So I know this is a problem that we have generally with this portfolio, is that a tremendous amount of good research is done, but one of the things that fell from your income this year was conferences. Yet you've got no idea from this how much income you actually ever got from conferences. So I'm not sure whether conferences come under other income, or whether they're part of grants and donations. I'd just like a bit more of that unpacked. Then onto the annual report. Well, another question, Jenny. There's an awful lot of research think tanks going on in South Africa. Do we have enough? Do we have too many? Are they competing? You say, you know, we talked about the science councils, but there seems to be a lot of research being done. Is there competition for the available sort of fund of money available for research? Also, how do you gel with NACI? You say you do have some liaison with them, but we now have, you know, DSC now funds too. Policy advisory bodies in NACI and in yourselves. Wanting to know this talk about a scientific advisor to government being appointed or an office being evolved. Do you know anything about that? Are you included in that? Is that part of where you might go? Then on the finances, I was... let me just find it. Your income... page 55 of the annual report, where under grants and donations we have money received from the Shuttleworth Foundation and the Ford Foundation, which money was paid back. The Ford Foundation was deferred, but there was some money that was refunded. Yes, the Shuttleworth Foundation was refunded. Not a lot of money, but why was that done? And also the financial future of the Academy is obviously of much concern. What are you doing to either gather more clients, or are you just hoping that DST is going to increase its funding? Thank you.
Right, that's one.
Thanks, Jefferson. Let me also then be the presenters for their presentation, and maybe also thank the Academy for having received an unqualified report. Two questions, Jefferson. Maybe the other one, there was an explanation which I missed, and if that's the case, please pardon me. The first question is with regards to the AU TWASC or TWAS Young Scientist Award that was not awarded in 2010 because there were still negotiations. What I'd like to find out is, are the negotiations completed? Are these awards going to continue, or what's going to be the situation, or the negotiations are still on? The other one is with regard to on page 46 of the AR, the AG on emphasis of matter, indicates that for the Academy to continue, there needs to be a donor support. And if there's no such donor support, then it means that the Academy won't be able to continue or won't sustain itself. What I'd like to find out is, do you envisage or foresee a situation where you wouldn't have a donation, where we wouldn't get donations, and if that does happen, what contingency plans do you have in place? The last question, Chairperson, and the presenters, is with regard to the challenges that I mentioned in this unpaginated or unnumbered, these unnumbered slides. Yes,
You can pick up that members are very unhappy about the number slides. They make it difficult for reference purposes. In the future, we will have to rectify that problem.
I pardon them, Jefferson, maybe because it's like that graph where one bar just disappeared. Maybe the numbers also just disappeared because maybe it's science, you know, some of us are... that you face after the academy. But what I find lacking, Chairperson, is the strategy or the measures to address these challenges. Maybe they were mentioned in passing, but this document, because I've had to browse through the annual report to see if the strategy to address them or mechanism to address these challenges is somewhere in this document, but I find it lacking. So I'd like to find out what is it that you are going to do to ensure that you address these challenges so that they do not recur or they do not become challenges for us. Thanks.
Honorable Tony.
No, thank you, Chair. First, let's not to add my voice, but more to say it's quite a reader-friendly presentation. Comment that, but also make an emphasis, it's quite difficult when a document is not numbered and really wrapping salt into your wound. I've just got two questions, and the last one is going to be a comment. In your goals, strategic priorities, goals, structure, strategic priorities, as you are presenting, I pick up that you were saying promotion of interest and awareness of science and education, science education to the general public. I hope I put that. Now, the question for me is, how do you, can you unpack that? Because when you are then talking about, you are talking about general public, you will then be referring to the communities, ordinary communities, who majority of them have never been, not because of their liking, have never been exposed to science as a subject and of interest. The second one is on scholar visits. In looking into this slide, I see that you have visited a couple of universities, but there are two provinces in Northern Lakes. I do. There are two provinces here that there are institutions of higher learning have not been visited, and why those are one day. We have got a university in Northwest, which is Potchefstroom, and again, it is a rural, and it has got all the characteristics and the layout of a province. In my view, that I would have thought that it should be advisable for you to visit. And obviously, my home one, and I'll always be passionate about that. The Eastern Cape, you have got a couple of them. You have got Rhodes, you have got the former UBE, you have got the Walter Sisulu. What is the criteria that you use in visiting? Because I would have thought that all the universities in this country. I'm raising that because science, whether we like it or not, science is in the center of whatever we do. It's in the center of what that young woman, old woman in the rural area is doing. It's in the center of what that young man and woman in the urban area is doing, whether learned or not, whether rich or poor, whether employed or unemployed. So that's my question. The last one, because majority of them have been asked by some of the members. We will always be passionate about this, to Ellen. In your staff, maybe in the next presentation, please reflect on, remember that we are a party that is leading in government, that have got an interest in ensuring that women and children, but taking it further, people with disabilities. And I haven't heard you, whether is it because it's in the breakdown of your stuff, that's why I'm saying, Honorable Chairperson, when they come back again, they must make the breakdown of the stuff within that race, gender, class. Maybe your staff would be coming from high. The last one, I have been looking here in the documents on your membership, whatever. No, Chair. It can't be accepted when this country, and again, as the party leading in government, that we want to ensure that women feature at all levels. Now, your reflection here in today's meeting coming to us, there is not a single female. What reflection are you giving to us? Are you also telling us that in your institution there are no women, for now irrespective of color and creed, there are no women that has got an ability to take us through just, and it's quite a disturbing feature, Chair. And when I was looking here, I was trying in the document, I think I did pick up yesterday, is that I think you have got just quite a, I saw two, there are three, only two, four. But it's quite on a more serious note. I think it's only that we can't go to an extent that if an entity comes here, we must prescribe. I think we must Parliament will have to, make that amendment. That infos will have to prescribe to you. You don't come and make any presentation if you are not going to ensure that majority of people that are coming to make presentation are women. Because let alone the issue, the debate in political circles about 50-50. On a more serious note, we do think that you have got, you may be having women who have got an ability to make presentation, but it's quite disturbing. In sitting down, you know, yesterday in the midterm budget speech of the Minister of Finance, I said to my colleague next to me, I don't understand whether are we making any moves in this country in ensuring that women are in strategic positions. The Minister of Finance is a male. His deputy is a male. His DG is a male. The chairperson of the portfolio committee is a male. And finance and science have got, finance and science have got that. So there is no other person who's going to ensure that, to enforce that, none other than ourselves as females. But I really, that's why I'm just I wanted to make that change. In future, for now we will credit them, but in future ensure that in your delegation coming here, it's a reflection that the society is led by both females and males. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I have also got some few questions here to fit in the system. The first one, Honourable Member noted here that it's quite a little bit disturbing last time we even had picked up that ASAF was even doing things that it was not supposed to be doing, such as looking at awarding people and so forth and so forth, which we felt that we have even some entities in the science system that are responsible for giving these awards and so forth. And I remember that we even said that focus, that anything that comes from there is where in fact the state of Syrah must go. So that's my first thing. My second question is, in your own in the analysis and the roles that you said you are doing, you are trying to assess knowledge of all things. We have some very recently our committee visited a very exciting research project on HIV, the Caprisa. And Caprisa is in many world magazines and papers and periodicals showing even in Nature, is showing the advancement of research in that field in South Africa. And when they presented their slides there, we were very excited that we say very little about ourselves. I would have expected, therefore, that those are types of things that we get the feeling about from the academy of how to strengthen those types of research or research potentials that we have in the country. Where to go after this and give advice even or give direction to others, the state, where these people should go. Because one of the things we found, they complained about many other things, including funding, that this work is known outside but not inside South Africa. Look at how much many papers are saying in the world, but in South Africa very little we hear about it, and we didn't even know, being the Portfolio Committee of Science and Technology, we're supposed to probably get this from you as the Academy of Science. Salaries, as has been reflected there, there was a very, very clear appeal yesterday from the Minister of Finance that many of the departments, most of their budget go to salaries, and so this is not sustainable for in the future for the government. Salaries, most of the budget must go to infrastructural development for job creation. Of course, I wouldn't expect that from the academy again because of what it's supposed to be doing. But of course, the knowledge that it will contribute to give direction, part of that, of what, how the infrastructure or how to redirect finances from salary to infrastructural development, those who are also the advice that should come from the academy of science. Those are the people who are, they represent the think tank of the country. Yes. Not confined in one purpose like NAKI, which is only advising the Minister of Science, but they look at the whole landscape of the land and advise accordingly. They even actually override decisions that come from smaller organizations like NAKI, because they have enough time and evaluate and give comment. That's how I expect it to be operating myself. That's how it has been operating in many countries that I've been to during my exile years. Now, you also said something about the relocation that part of the monies that have been used, they were eaten up by relocation. I thought the Department of Science and Technology is one outstanding building. Why would you want to move out of such a nice green building? You want to pollute elsewhere? I just want to know why, because I thought that building is a bigger space, enough space and so forth. Why would you like to relieve such a building? In terms of the nuclear studies, I just didn't catch it. There were three things that I recorded. You said you are working with Japanese science councils, French. What was that in French?
French
Academy of Science. And then you said you are also with London, who is in London? you award people when they've made such an achievement. Now, there is that professor I'm talking about from the University of Pretoria, from the University of Cape, by the way, Professor Majosi. Professor Majosi, I've seen a number of his awards international. I've seen one even recent one. And I know he's also one of the specialists on pinch technology and so forth. So there's another lady who is now the vice president of the Medical Research Council. She was nominated in the United States as one of the best 10 in cancer research by American Cancer Research Academies Association. And I have not seen. Actually, yes, he lived in one. She was recorded by HSRC to something they never recognized. In fact, HSR, they had no body there. They were trying to introduce her there. They needed a person of genetic engineering. I think he had produced more than 20 PhDs at first. But he was in. Until very recently, when I got to know that she has been appointed the vice president of the Medical Research Council. But I'm trying to say that we have all these types of, what are the criteria for an institution like yours to really be seen as an equity institution in terms of developing talents and our efforts? That's my question. Thank you.
I start with the answers, I hope. You've asked us a comprehensive set of questions, and I thought I would start with the Honourable Member's question here about the gender composition of this particular delegation. Because originally the composition was going to be different. Professor Roseanne Dyack, who was our executive officer, was going to be here. But unfortunately, she has had to go to the United States as part of an important panel, and so she was not able to attend, and we apologize for that. So we apologize for it on two grounds. One, that she wasn't able to attend, and two, that unfortunately that resulted in the composition of our delegation, which we will attend to in future. In the other general point that I would like to make in relation to the questions is that the Academy itself does not do any research. So we are not like the CSIR or the ARC or the Medical Research Council, which is essentially commissioning the primary research. What the Academy does is it makes use of that primary research in order to provide its evidence-based advice. And I think that that's one of the clearest ways in which you can distinguish between what the Academy does and what the other institutions in the national system of innovation do. So I think that answers a number of questions in relation to why you're doing this research or how you're commissioning the research. I would like to just answer partly one of the questions that you asked in relation to the nature of academies, because academies in different parts of the world are different. Our academy is focused, like many of the academies, on the recognition of excellence and on providing policy advice. Other academies have other functions as well. Some of the other academies are funding agencies, similar to the NRF. And so the academies then fulfill a dual function. And other academies have an even more expanded function, such as in Russia and in China, as you mentioned, where they run research units and research councils, and in some cases even run companies. So, for instance, the Chinese Academy of Science has over 100,000 employees because it's running a whole set of other institutes. Our academy is not constituted that way, and it doesn't fit into the national system of innovation in the same way that those academies do. So that's partly an answer to your question about the nature of academies. And I would like to say that I couldn't endorse more wholeheartedly your own view of what academicians and academies should be. So I agree with that completely. So the issue is that the academies use the collective resource of the membership. The membership then represents a set of expertise, and you can use that set of expertise in a number of ways. One of the ways you can do it is by appointing them to the panels that undertake the study. The other way in which you can make use of them is by joining the committees, and the committees are the places which are set up in a number of different fields, and those committees have the task to generate new ideas for studies that the academy might like to undertake. So the academy members are a very important resource. And also, to come to one of your questions, Honourable Chair, the particular person who you mentioned, Professor Majorzi, is a member of the academy and was heavily involved in the establishment of the Young Academies of Science. So he, in a sense, created the connection because he's so outstanding in his own field for the development of the academy. In relation to the question about proactive or requested studies, I've lost the presentation for some reason or other. I'm not quite sure why. Some of these studies are proactively developed. The one on HIV, for instance, and the one on scholarly publishing were proactively produced. Others of the studies are requested. And in a sense, the Academy has to develop a track record of providing credible advice and providing studies that are valued by the individuals who want them, and I think we're developing in that direction. So I think it will always be a mix of proactively developed studies and requested studies, and the proactive studies arise either from recommendations that are made by individual members or recommendations that are made by the committees. And the number of studies that we undertake is determined by two factors. It's determined by the capacity of our secretariat. Our secretariat has grown quite strongly. The growth is mainly in relation to creating the capacity to service the studies and to create the capacity to service the scholarly publishing program. And we don't envisage that the secretariat is going to grow significantly beyond this point, because we had to get to the point where we could actually deliver what was required of us. I've discussed how I think there is a relationship between the Academy and the other science councils, and I hope that I've provided a clear answer to that. In relation to the relationship with government and other entities, I think that we obviously have a very strong relationship with the Department of Science and Technology, because they are responsible for the Academy, and via that department we have been attempting to gain access to the other departments to indicate what the value of the Academy is. And I think that the commentary that we produced on the IRP has indicated some value to the Department of Energy. So it's an ongoing process of trying to market the Academy as a source of advice. We're also very aware of the fact that advice comes from many areas, not just from the Academy. And so what we have to do is we have to indicate what is uniquely valuable about the Academy's advice, not to say that it's the only potentially advisory body. As far as the DST contract is concerned, the scholarly program was initially done on the basis of a contract, and it arose out of one of the recommendations of that first study. But now that has been converted into the core funding that the Academy is getting. Then there was a question about whether we would be interested in doing studies in relation to solar energy and wind energy. The answer is yes, the Academy could undertake those studies, but we would have to have a clear indication from the individuals who were seeking that advice, what the nature of that advice might be. So in the case of the nuclear safety, which we have been talking about, nuclear energy is a key element of the current IRP, and the questions of nuclear safety are ones which are of paramount importance after the accident. And so for that reason, I think it was important for the Academy to become involved in that. There are other aspects of energy that we could become involved in. Solar and wind is one. Another one is fracking. And the issue there is there is a lot of evidence available, and a number of international academies have actually produced fairly significant studies. And what our academy could do is, rather than reinvent the wheel, is to actually review those studies and provide a review of that to policymakers if you were interested in that. Then there was the issue about the costs of the studies. What we do in relation to the costs of the studies, they're the direct costs of the Secretariat's time in actually supporting the studies. There is also the costs of individuals who are asked to do particular studies on behalf of the panel members. But the panel members, who are the ones who sift all the evidence, who approve the final study, are not paid for the time that they input on those panels. And I should also indicate to you that the panels operate on reaching a consensus, because the people on their panels have divergent interests and sometimes divergently conflicting interests. And I may say to the members here that in coming to our commentary on the IRP was one of the most interesting activities that the Academy has been involved in, because the members had strongly conflicting opinions. And what we had to do is to say the way in which the Academy works is, at the end of the day, when you leave here with a commentary, that is, conflicting interests have to have been eliminated. And if they can't be, then they're not part of the commentary. So it's a particular methodology that works quite well. So I think that answers the question about the volunteerism. As far as the part-time staff are concerned, we have a number of part-time staff members who act as editors for journals and sub-editors and so on, and they will always be part-time. So that's not a full-time position, and it's to undertake a particular task. Then I think there's a question about impact, and academies always have a great deal of difficulty in measuring impact. I think the only significant way in which you can measure the impact of what we do is whether the recommendations are actually translated and implemented. And I think that in relation to, there are two aspects to it. One is the degree to which the Academy's reports change people's attitudes to a particular problem, so that they understand the problem in a more detailed sense. But I think the actual impact which the Academy is going to have needs to be measured in terms of, have its recommendations been implemented? And the second thing is, has the Academy been asked to do follow-up studies? And just to give you one example, in the case of the HIV study, what happened there was that we were then did two subsequent studies, one on clinical research and one on micronutrients. And both of those made a number of recommendations, and in both cases those recommendations are being considered by the Department of Health. So I think that's the way in which we try to get a measure of the impact of the way in which we operate our conferences. And then there was the question about the statement on academic freedom, and I don't know if Professor Givers would like to comment on that one.
Yes, thank you. The answer to that is that as a member of what is now called the network, global network of science academies, previously the Inter-Academy Panel, we take part in the development of statements which are generated internationally. And the academic freedom, therefore, was not a hint, if you like, that South Africa had a special problem. It was the identification of academic freedom as an absolute requirement internationally for the proper development of scientific ideas and scientific progress. So we took part in that, edited it, and made sure that we were satisfied. The same was done by about 90 other academies. So that statement was issued in South Africa on behalf of a global network. And I think the same was true for the teaching of evolution in schools. It was again an international statement. But I think, Chair, that we also would contemplate issuing a national statement on our own initiative if the circumstances made that necessary. Thank you.
Chair, then I would like to deal with some of the issues that relate to funding. I think that in relation to the funding, the Academy generally participates in the organization of conferences which relate to Academy matters. Otherwise we don't become involved in them, and we only become involved in them if they sell funding. Now the effect of that, of course, is that you see it in the income and you see it in the expenditure, and then the following year you won't see anything else in that funding. We've been involved in two conferences which we've hosted. First of all, we were asked by the Academy of Science of the Developing World to host their national conference in Durban, and that was in 2009. And then we were asked in 2010 to host the African Science Academies Initiative Development conference, which you participated in. And so those are the reasons why we were actually involved in those conferences, because they brought academies together to discuss academy matters. Otherwise, we don't become involved. It's not our mandate to actually run conferences.
The one you said is in 2 weeks' time will be in Uganda, who is running that one?
The Uganda Academy of Science is running that one. And there's been an annual meeting of the African Academies of Sciences, and it's moving from one country to the next. For us, it's very important, because when a national academy is holding one of those conferences, it gives an opportunity to raise the profile of the academy in the home country, and to also make policymakers in that country aware of what the contribution is that science academies can make in their own national systems. So I think from that point of view, those kinds of conferences are significant events. Then our relationship with NACI. NACI, as you indicated, advises the department, and on occasions NACI has requested the Academy to undertake some investigations of issues. So I think that what we would like to do is to ensure that there's a strong relationship between NACI and the Academy, but we do different things. And as you see from the composition of our council, there is a NACI representative on the council, so there's an actual direct connection between the two. We have heard discussions about a scientific advisor to the government. Our own view is that the Academy could fulfill that role fairly effectively, but that's not a matter for the Academy to decide on. That's a matter for policymakers to decide on. But certainly in many other countries, the National Academy fulfills that role. And the particular example that you gave in your comments is one clear example of that. And then perhaps in relation to the funding, Mr. Chilwani would like to can comment on the why we had to return some money to the Shuttleworth Foundation.
Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you for that. Yeah, what happened here is that Shuttleworth Foundation gave us that grant. It was for a particular activity. What happened is, in us of undertaking that, we found that somewhere down the line the landscape has changed, and therefore the focus has shifted. We have then had to revert back to Shuttleworth Foundation to say, can we use those funds in this direction, given that the landscape has changed? And they said, no, no, no. In actual fact, they have also changed their focus. What they will prefer is that we refund those remaining funds. That is the reason why we refunded.
Chair, if I could continue then with the other questions. In relation to the AU TWAS award, those negotiations have been completed. And so we did make the award in 2011. And it involved a negotiation between the Academy DST and the Academy of Science of the Developing World. In relation to the activities of the Academy and the donor support which you mentioned, essentially the Academy's activities are determined by the funding that we have available. And so the activities are scaled appropriately to what our income is. And in relation to any new studies that we are going to undertake, we would look at making use of some of the core funding to support the Secretariat, but the costs associated with undertaking the study would have to be borne by the individuals who were commissioning it. And so I think that in a sense, that gives us a degree of flexibility to be able to match our activities to the income that we get. Strategies to address the challenges, I have to confess those are not in the document. You are quite correct in identifying that they're not there. And there are a number of strategies that we're in the process of developing to actually address those. And I'm sorry we've lost the slides, because I could have gone back to some of them. But certainly in relation to actually increasing the impact of what the Academy is doing, we are developing a number of new communication strategies to be able to do that. We obviously have to heighten our interaction with a range of different government departments. And in relation to the membership of the Academy, I think we have to look at a different way in which we are going to identify and nominate members. But that's a matter which we are engaged with at the moment. In relation to the engagement with the general public, we try to do this mostly via the media, but in addition to that, we've tried to do it via the production of that science magazine, and ensuring that science magazine gets distributed into very large numbers of schools at a local level. I think there's more that we could do about that, and that's clearly something that we're going to have to pay attention to in the future. As far as the span of visits are concerned, this is an issue which has been discussed by one of the council members, because the difficulty with these scholar visits is that the individuals have limited time available to actually visit the country. And the effect of that, as you identified very clearly, is that in essence they visit the major centres, and they miss the centres that are not on the major routes of SAA. So what that means is, I think that we have to reconsider how we arrange these scholarly visits, where we can get the individuals to come for longer periods of time. Then we do make sure that they go to the Eastern Cape, that they go to KwaZulu-Natal, and that they go to the center of the country as well. Very often, the Free State is missed altogether because the connections are not very good. So it's clearly something that we need to attend to. And then I indicated earlier that unfortunately our executive officer, Professor Roseanne Dyer, was supposed to be here today, but unfortunately she had to attend a conference in the United States and had to apologize. So I apologize for that at the moment. I think we've discussed the issue of the conflicts of interest between the various entities and redundancy and roles. I think we are trying to identify very clearly what it is the Academy does. In relation to the awards that you mentioned, the Academy has now had a discussion with the NRF and with the NSTF, and we hope to involve TIA as well, and that is to have one national award ceremony in which all of those bodies participate and in which there's partitioning of the roles to give awards in different areas. In relation to your comment on CAPRISA, it's very interesting that you should mention your visit there, because the one of the people who leads that, Professor Karim, is actually the recipient of the gold medal of the Academy for 2011, which will be part of our annual report for next year. But it is an indication, I think, that the Academy is looking at the really significant science and technology and other developments that are taking place in the country, and we try to identify the individuals who have been instrumental in achieving those in giving the awards. And I wondered whether Professor Giovas at this point would like to make another comment about the awards themselves.
Thank you, Professor Crew. Yes, I'd like to take up your pertinent question, Honourable Chairperson, on the issue of what are the criteria that are used. But firstly, when the Academy was planned and later established, so as recently as 1996 and with the Act in 2001, one of the principal discussion points was how broad the Academy should be. First of all, there was a big lobby that it should be science and technology in the narrow sense, and eventually there was a huge majority for having it in the broad sense, that all empirical inquiry, whether it is social, economic, or legal, or whatever, is included. The second was, should the criteria be those which are, in a sense, used everywhere until now? We were influenced by the fact that Mexico, almost uniquely in developing countries, had changed from the model of, if you like, the thatched white 80-year-old mathematician as the typical member of an academy, which unfortunately was what we had in Nigeria the first time we visited Nigeria. That they changed, they said we needed to have youth, we needed to have energy, we needed to have demonstration that people who became members were willing to put their skills and their knowledge to public use. And that is how we developed the double criterion of membership of our academy, which is that you must have excellence in your discipline or your scholarship, plus a demonstrated willingness and success in turning that to good advantage for society. And so in that sense, we are somewhat unique, because that's not the case of the Royal Society nor the case of the U.S. National Academies. However, it has led to an emphasis, as you heard, in our gold medal, that is, that the same criterion applies, that it must be something which has been an outstanding discovery or work that has led to marked public benefits. So therefore, in our vision, we see ourselves as an apex organization for knowledge. We obviously are very concerned about your point about avoiding arbitrariness and having peer review and having thorough thought given to when awards are made, when elections take place to committees or to panels or to election of an academy, and as well as accepting papers for publications and recognizing that. So therefore, this is a matter very close to our hearts, the question of equity in recognition of quality and of a contribution. So we have done everything we can in the area of publications, of scholarly publications and books, to improve the peer review so that it's independent and multiple, and no single opposing or hostile opinion can cause a paper not to be published. And the editors have something which we've published is a national code of best practice for editing and peer review designed to eliminate that, to eliminate the practice of interfering with the proper publication. It's difficult to go beyond that, Chairperson, but nevertheless, the point you have made is accepted wholeheartedly, and that is at the core of what we're trying to achieve, is to ensure that the recognition is fair and appropriate and is not caused by any other motives or factors. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, then there are one or two other questions that we still have to address. I think we've taken note of your comments in relation to the comments that were made by the Minister of Finance, and that certainly will be an issue in our financial planning in the future. On the question of the relocation from DST, DST itself had demands on the space in their own building. And so therefore it became necessary for us to relocate to a building close by. And it is in a nice environment with trees and so on, so it's reasonably green, but not as green as the DST building. And then
where did you move to?
We moved to Persicor Park, which is when you go down Maring Nordia from DST towards the Botanic Gardens, it's on your left there. So NACI and the Academy and the CHE and various other similar organizations are located in that area, and it's convenient for its location in proximity to the CSIR and the DST, but it's also convenient in its proximity to the other organizations so that you can have discussions relatively easily. And then the final question that I think I need to address is your question in relation to the tension between publication and patenting. My own view about that is that if you are patenting efficiently, then you can patent within about 6 months. So you don't need to have a trade-off between patenting and publication. What you need to do is you need to have a delay in publication rather than a withholding of publication. And it's really about the management of the process. It takes roughly 6 months to patent and protect the idea. And once you've protected the idea, then you're free to publish, because patenting is a form of publication. Once you've been granted a patent, it's in the public domain, and people can make use of that information. So it's about research management, I think, more than anything else. And it involves two things. One is the individual academics have to understand that they're not simply free to go and present their work at conferences, and they're not simply free to go ahead and publish. What they need to do is they need to do the patenting step first, which will take 6 months, roughly, and that after that they can make their presentations at the conferences and they can publish the work in the scholarly journals. And so that, I think, is where we have to do some additional work, is in relation to the actual management of the process, so that you don't stop the publication. And in many of the high technology areas, when it comes to commercializing the patents, because patents themselves have no value, it's only when you actually commercialize them and turn them into products that they have a value. Very often, you will not get an investment in the commercialization of the work unless it's been published, because the investors want to know that the peers in the field recognize this work as good work. So actually, the two go hand in hand rather than being two separate activities. Chair, I hope we've answered all of the questions asked by the honourable members of the committee. Thank you.
Yeah, I hope so. Actually, I was just worried about time now because we have other commitments. But without wasting time, I, on behalf of the committee, thank you very much. I think we have shared very important views, and as you go along developing programs within NASAF, you'll take into consideration points that have been raised here. In particular, I think you must really be vigilant of people that have got adversarial attitudes in undermining other people's talents. I was very happy the way Professor Kifasike handled that matter within a week, and the report came back to me that, you know, enough matters of this nature have to go to Parliament in order to be addressed, when actually this is pure talent and professionalism. Parliament is not supposed to be coming in to intervene, but they did thank Professor Kivas for having intervened, and the publication that was hidden came out and was published. They have done that also with me. I have first an interview, that's why we discussed it. They hid it, and then they brought it up, and they knew it was useless for the conference. So that's very bad. It makes institutions of your level totally undermined. And I think you must guard against that, you see, because there can be no development when talents are suppressed. You see. Thank you very much, otherwise. Have a good trip back to Pretoria. I think members will have to remain just some few minutes and we'll handle our matters. I think we've got the researcher here who must give us an overview of what she did quickly so that we don't waste time. And then the task team can then also help us by its own input. Thank you very much, otherwise, for all of you. I think the researcher must come here. I'll come here in front. That is why I decided that she must just address us so that we quickly round up things.
Department of Innovation, Industry, Science and Research. And have been cooperating with Australia since 2006 on science and technology. However, the department does not characterize them as a high priority partner at this point. So the cooperation is mainly with our higher education institutions, and the areas of cooperation are innovation management, biotechnology, low carbon energy technologies, climate change, especially in the Southern Indian Ocean, natural resource management, biodiversity and water, and the humanities and social sciences. It's Australia. Then for Brazil, we have the Ministry of Science and Technology, responsible for the National Policy on Science and Technology. And the two main agencies within the ministry is the Financing Body for Studies and Projects and the National Council for Scientific and Technological Development, and they all have their respective research units. The strategic priority areas for Brazil is to expand its science and technology system, to promote technological innovation specifically in its enterprises, and to pursue research in strategic areas, which is information and communication technologies, health products, biofuels, agribusiness, and its nuclear program, and then also to pursue science and technology for social development. We've been partnering with Brazil since 2003, but the agreement remained unimplemented until 2008. Brazil is classified as a priority country by the DSD for cooperation, and areas of cooperation are quite extensive. It's agro-processing, industrial technologies, biodiversity, biotech, energy, environmentally friendly technology, ICT, materials research, space science, and indigenous knowledge. And then for China, China's been implementing a range of programs since the 80s, and it was specifically to grow its innovation industries. The key one is its key technologies R&D program, and its high-tech R&D program, and then they have a basic research program. We've been cooperating with them since the late 90s, and the areas are biotech, ICT, new materials and advanced manufacturing, traditional medicines, and sustainable resource management. And China is a priority partner of the DST. Next we have Japan, and it's the National Institute of Science and Technology Policy, which falls under the Ministry of Education, Culture, Sport, Science and Technology, in charge of science policy. And we've been cooperating with them since 2003, and they are prioritized as a strategic partner by the DST. Current areas include, our cooperation includes the life sciences, environment and climate change, energy research, human capital development, material science and nanotechnology, and South Africa received a substantial amount of development assistance from Japan. And then we have Malaysia. I think it's Malaysia, Japan, and Singapore, where the English translation of their websites was very difficult to follow. So I wasn't always too sure of how the agencies link together. And then for Malaysia, it's the Ministry of Science, Technology and Innovation. And here it's the National Council for Scientific Research and Development, which acts as an advisory body. And it's comprised of representatives of both the public and the private sector, and their main function is to provide direction on science and technologies, science and technology policies and priorities for the country. There's no science and technology agreement between Malaysia and South Africa, and currently the DST stated that they have no interest in pursuing such an agreement. But should they do so, the areas that they'll cooperate on are biotechnology, nanotechnology, photonics, ICT, and innovation. Singapore. This one was very difficult to find technology and research, which serves the public safety industries activities, and the Economic Development Board, which implements the private sector activities. The national criteria has been to cluster research agencies geographically to provide national knowledge hubs with ties to international institutes, and the two specific areas is ICT and biomedical research. And here for the one, for the ICT activities they've created what they call a fusionopolis. So it's sort of geographically, you know, they've... Yes. And the next one is called the biopolis for the biomedical research cluster. Sorry. And it's hoped that these two clusters will drive global centers of excellence, you know, for Singapore. There is no cooperation agreement between South Africa and Singapore, and Singapore was not interested in working with South Africa when approached by us. And then finally, we have the Republic of Korea, and it's the Ministry of Science and Technology, which is responsible for implementing the science policies. They have a number of programs to drive the national system of innovation, and they are a priority partner of the DST and have been since 2004. And the current areas of cooperation include space science and astronomy, nuclear energy, biotechnology, nanotechnology, innovation, and hydrogen and fuel cells. I think it's the last page. Members can just see that I just pulled some numbers from the Global Competitive Index in terms of the quality of their maths and science education and their capacity for innovation.
I think we can even take our sense there.
And Singapore comes up.
Yeah, I know Singapore is really...
And just one final thing. I know when members identified these seven countries, it's with the aim of visiting them in January next year. It was also that it should be a warm country. Out of the seven, yes, it's only Australia and Brazil that will have warm weather during that time. Otherwise, be prepared for lots of snow. Excuse me.
Thank you very much, Regulator. I think that's why I said she must just give an overview so that you can then quickly make inputs and leave the task team to finalize their proposal, probably. Can you open your microphone?
Sorry, Chair, I did drop a note that I've also got a meeting at after 12. Yeah, for me, it's now because of weather. In terms of order of priority, it will be two countries that I will propose the committee to look into. That would be Brazil and obviously in Australia. But my in order of priority and preference, it will be Brazil. Otherwise, I did manage to, and want to thank Renee for the work that has been done. I will request to be released.
Okay, no, that's fine. We can release you because of listening to the report of contributed. Let me ask the members. By myself, I can say here that I'm very impressed about the programs in South Korea, and that we are also even in good spirit of cooperation with them on very strategic fields such as nanotechnology, the forthcoming six nuclear power stations that are going to be built. I think they are, unfortunately, we need to really look into the weather. And I know in space technology also, we are also collaborating a lot. Myself, if it was not a matter of weather, and the concept of Technopolis, they have all what we want. But let's look at what other members are saying.
Chair, I must apologize for not having read the document. I was out of the country when it was distributed, and I hadn't seen it, in fact. But readers,
We might want to just consider that issue when we look, choose a country. That may also apply to China, but also I don't know. But I'm also quite interested in South Korea and what they're doing.
I'm sorry,
I'm saying if it is going to be a warm country, if that's going to be an important criterion, then I think Australia would be, I think, more interesting to us. I mean, it's a small country in terms of population. It's, you know, there's a lot of parallels to ourselves, which I think are quite important. So I'd be interested to take that.
I'd also just like to inform members that on our agenda for later in November, we have Professor Alsterheider presenting some work for COP17, as well as giving input to the country that the committee picks to do the international study tour. So he's willing to come and give members a briefing, you know, more extensive information on whatever country you pick in terms of the cooperation agreements that exist, what projects are happening, and that would probably also help members then decide what specifically or what area of focus or areas of focus you'd like to have identified. But he's willing to then to come and give us further extensive information on the country that you choose.
Okay, thanks. Right. Any further inputs?
When I responded to the request in September, I said that my first priority was Brazil, followed by Korea.
Yeah, the only problem is that Honoris is saying, hey, we've had a number of people from Panama to Brazil, although we have not been there as a science said. I'm not sure what the attitudes or the attitudes are already, but
I think the priority should be what we want as a committee. Not you know, we're not going to be seeing the same people at housing we're just eating necessarily. And it should be really what we want to go to.
Yeah, I know that. It's not a final statement. I mean, it's just these are inputs. Don't be angry about inputs. Inputs have got to just come in and flow, and then we process them, and then we come with a product. There was another hand. Okay, I think therefore I have got where we are. We had appointed the task team. They have given for their preferences, unfortunately, they are divergent. Honorable Smith feels like I feel, Honorable Shim felt as she feels, and what we agree, because we must come with an agreed voice here. Which country are we choosing so that we must start processing that?
I'm going to propose that we take the two countries that we proposed, because it's not given that we choose a country and the country will accept us. Any of the two countries that have been chosen, then it will be the country that we go to, because it doesn't mean when we say South Korea, then South Korea, we might want to go there in January when it's warm or when it's cold, but it will depend whether they accept us. So if we choose one country and that country doesn't accept us, do we have to come back and sit again and say, let's go through those countries again and see which one?
But you must have a priority in them if at all both of them agree, because we won't have time to come back here. Exactly.
I'm sorry, Chairperson.
Just to add, I mean, another consideration could be, although of course it depends on what the first choice is, that you could combine. I mean, for example, if one went to South Korea, you could go there and on the way back go to Australia or something, or if you went, you know, depending which combination where countries are close to each other, you could do Malaysia and Singapore, say, I'm not proposing it, but instead of being reliant on one country only, we could do something of that nature. But,
yeah, that's true.
committee, we are interested in Korea and one of the two, Brazil or Australia. So we'll take what has been decided by the committee. We'll agree because we have highlighted the countries that we are interested in. We'll accept anything that has been finalized.
That's not the management committee. It's the task team. There is a task team which already established, which must process. So the task team must process, therefore, at the end, in conjunction with the secretaries, which count finally. But remember that the management committee is still tasked with going and negotiating, bringing forward our slot, which was July. Bring it down to January. Once we have decided it concretely where we want to go.
I'm tempted to second Honorable Smith's proposal. But I think if the possibility of touching more than one country, then we do that. That will also give us a chance to, an opportunity to maybe to compare what we have learned in one country with the other one and maybe bring it to our situation in South Africa. Because we say that some have similarities, then we'll be able to compare even those and link it to us as a country here. So I'm supporting Honorable Smith's proposal, although it doesn't protect me when it comes to cold and wind.
Rani, you wanted to say something?
Just to give members an idea, so far for Brazil, it's the first choice of three members, and South Korea, it's the first choice of two members, and then the second choice of one member. So Brazil seems to be a greater preference at this moment, recording first and second choices.
I'm just sort of thinking, if this is a coherent thought. with the, obviously the Deputy Director General, after Hada, did he, in discussions with you, perhaps say which would be perhaps more beneficial to us from his obviously in-depth knowledge of both countries? Or did he only just sort of say that he might just come at the end once we've made our decision? Did he give any kind of guidance, perhaps?
No, he didn't.
Okay.
He just said that he would be really happy to assist the committee in the decision, and he would also to provide information on the country of the committee. I think he was wary of maybe
It'll be good if we could finalise that now, because what happens is we keep on postponing, and then we get a missed deadline. In fact, I didn't even realise the issue you just raised, which was there's an issue of changing our slot, time slot from June to January. I didn't realise that. It's the first I've heard of it. I thought we were already in the January slot.
No.
So, I mean, that's interesting to me.
Yeah.
I would then suggest that perhaps we prioritise Korea.
Right. So it is therefore, I think, coming closer to everybody's choice. Then we can then see a closer count around there to go past it, which may, Korea, all of them are together, clustered there, Japan, Australia, all of them are there. I think it will be quite useful.
Yeah.
Okay, right. We will give Shamas to go ahead and check which ones are available around January, so that then once we know, then we can go and discuss with the House Chair as a management committee. Okay, agreed.
went to the tier, we went to the biotech thing down south of Durban. You know, I mean, are those things all meant to be enumerated, or are these simply examples?
Yeah.
If they're all meant to be enumerated, then there's a lot more to add.
No, some of them, they cluster them together in paragraphs.
Well, that's, where's the tier? Where's the biotech thing down Durban? Where's Sansa?
There is Sansa.
Where's Salt?
It's
salt.
It's
salt. It's one of their salt.
Where is it?
Let's see if I read it. There's SKA and Meerkat. There's no salt.
No, but this is a different report.
We went to Hartbeer. We went to the Astronomy Centre. We went to the Space Centre. I mean, all I'm saying, those things aren't here. This is only meant to be representative of a few.
Yeah, I'm thinking that because this report is not all of it of what we've done in terms of budgetary implications.
I think if there's specific things that business wants to see in the report, then they can say what can still be linked to that. In the outline, they say you can put in tools that can be used to substantiate your report. Then you can use some of your visits that you encountered. So if you want a detailed one of all the visits in incorporated, then we can do that. If there's some particular ones you want, and maybe to make a link to the annual reporting, then we can do that. But then I just need some guidelines as to what specifically. If you want it all, or just some, or put in more specific ones that you want.
I think the problem arises from, for me at least, in the opening sentence of 7.1. It says, in fulfilling its oversight mandate, the committee undertook oversight visits to some of the entities and projects, etc. But the question is, it doesn't say that these below are simply examples of a few that we went to. It gives the impression that this is the whole lot.
Mm.
All I'm saying is, either we say in the introduction that following a mere example, we went to a lot more, or if this is meant to be the list, then we need to be exhaustive. So I don't know, either approach, I don't really mind which one it is, but it's just that it does, it gives the impression that these are the oversight visits we did, when in fact it's not the oversight visits, we did a lot more than this. So it just maybe, you know, I'm not disagreeing, it could be examples only, but then it should be clear that's the case.
I think we must also have a purpose that this report actually is about putting our opinion as to where funding should be focused from the Treasury. Not just, I think that's what they want. That in our oversight, that is where they think money should be focused. For instance, remember what they said about the Space Agency lack of money in capacitating even the new satellite after failure of Subandhili and things like that. I think the Secretary must focus on where we think funding, working together with me, of course, and probably the liaison officer here, they must look into where funding should be focused. I know Sansa, we said it needs to be more funded in terms of taking the space agency activities further. I think what we have here, members can come with inputs, which areas we need to focus on in terms of saying that the Treasury must beef up funding.
That's quite a major issue.
Yeah, it's much more. But I think that's what it is. I think this is not about just the whole oversight, but you say during our oversight, these are the things that we picked up, and this is where we had the... But the Secretary can look into reports, because the reports can guide her about what issues were raised in each of those oversight visits, and then we can then analyze in terms of recommending more funding in particular spheres of those oversight visits.
required to do an analysis of the budget and where we think it should stay the same and where it should change across all entities.
Yeah.
Are we meant to list them to say, you know, entity A, we're happy with the budget, entity B, we think it's a bit short here, entity C, I mean, is this what we need to do?
That is what I'm supposed to do.
Well, that we need.
You see, it's a big exercise because I remember when we attended the workshop on this, there was even a suggestion that we need, probably two committees need to have representative when departments go and negotiate with Treasury so that we are informed by those negotiations. If we are not in those negotiations, are we going to know really what the department needs? That's why I'm saying that in such a case, we need the liaison officer to tell us which are the crucial areas and simply recommend those areas. Should we agree? It's a very difficult exercise. They did say that there are different models in the world, and they took some few models, and from there, they promised that they would train us. We have not had the training. And they promised that probably one best thing to do would be to have people represented, committees represented, during the departments go to negotiate with Treasury so that we can have the inside story of what are really the needy areas. It's a very difficult, it's a very comprehensive thing. I think for now, let's try to be as simple as possible. And simply utilize the list that we can think of in terms of. I think what we need to talk about here is the new that we need to probably, you know, funding for TIA, which is new, which is being put together, SANSA, you know, and other things. We can take it from there, or we can get probably ministerial proofs. I do not know.
Yeah, when does it have to be submitted?
By month,
isn't it?
That's normally before the incident is expected to wait for it, I
think. Because to think of the deadline, Chair, I was going to say, let it go as is. Because it's a learning curve, as you say. Each year, you get more thorough in your analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And if the deadline is like now, let's leave it as it is, and next year, apply our minds more to the to that, you know, particular issue.
I even doubt if they'll be able to even themselves read all those things and really address them. I think, let's just push it as it is. They'll tell us if it is not ready, then we'll then make it ready. Okay, agreed. So, Shanaz was just at that, but I just thought that. I think we've come to the end. Honorable, thank you very much. We'll take it from there. Okay, thanks. Sorry. Here the copy is of this deputy minister's speech. There's a conference that has opened up, very important also for us. It's kind of a follow-up from the one I attended in.
one, they've invited both the minister and the committee. I will be